They have broken bread together and shared the cup. He washed their feet even as they squirmed. But more and more, Jesus has been speaking in concerning ways, worrying the disciples. Now they've set out into the night, walking into this darkened garden outside Jerusalem. In the other Gospels, we hear accounts of Jesus spending time in prayer and the disciples struggling to stay awake. But here in John's Gospel, the story lurches forward. Here is Judas. Here now are soldiers, torches blazing in the night, weapons drawn and ready. Jesus steps forward. Everyone is suddenly still, holding their breath, waiting to see what will happen. He preempts the soldiers' action with a question. "Whom are you looking for?" He asks them plainly. At first blush, it seems obvious that this is a rhetorical question. Of course they are looking for Jesus. He knows it. His disciples know it. But as I've been sitting with the Passion this year, I've wondered if maybe Jesus is continuing to teach, continuing to offer a path toward abundant life, offering it even to these soldiers who come to take him to the cross. I've wondered if this could be a question for us to carry also. Whom are you looking for? For the soldiers, the answer seems pretty straightforward. They are just doing their job. Head down, stay in line, get it done. They didn't choose this. They're not in charge. And they see the reasoning. The city is on edge, and like the Roman officials, the soldiers must fear a popular uprising. They can guess that many more people would die that way. It's not hard to justify this action. They can take this one man, make an example of him, and calm everyone back down. They can scare them back into quiet submission. Yes, they all know he's innocent. But it's for everyone else's good. Jesus is an easy scapegoat. Whom are you looking for? It is a big ask to open our hearts to something more, especially in a crisis moment like the one unfolding there in the garden. But what if they could look for another way, for someone else? What if they could name the longing that lies hidden somewhere deep in their hearts? What if we could do the same? Lest we fall right into the trap of merely choosing another scapegoat, let's be clear that it's not just the soldiers who get confused here. They are not the only ones searching for the wrong person. Many of Jesus' followers are looking for a Messiah who will come with great military power to overthrow the occupying army. Someone who will set them free with the same violence the oppressor uses, simply by exerting even more of it. This will not be Jesus. Some of the disciples want a clever Messiah. They want someone brilliant who will slip through the grasp of the powerful, dodging this way and that to avoid this fate. But that would mean backing down from his teaching and his prophetic actions. Jesus can't flip tables in the temple and evade the authorities at the same time. He can't heal the crowds right when they most need help without the leaders taking note. He can't live out his love undercover. Plenty of people want a magician to come as the Messiah, someone who will wave their hand and instantly fix it all. And my goodness, does this sound appealing some days? And this, too, is off the table. Jesus is walking this balance of being fully God and also fully human. He will not choose one part of his identity at the expense of the other. We see this more clearly today than any other day. Alongside this incisive question of whom we are looking for, there's a promise that comes in the garden, too. Seeing that his disciples are at risk for arrest, Jesus redirects the scene, making sure that the soldiers take him but not the others. This, the gospel writer tells us, is to fulfill the word that he had spoken. I did not lose a single one of those whom you gave me. We hear this promise, and then through the rest of the Passion, he shows us how he's going to make that so. His friends will fall away. We all do, time and again. But he does not lose us. With each step, with each word, he enters more deeply into this promise. As he enters more completely into his humanity, he comes to know the fullness of being human by learning firsthand what it is to suffer and to die. For the whole of Christian history, people have tried to find a way to turn this gruesome event into something orderly and logical and under control. I think, in large part, it's because they want to see Jesus not as a victim, but as the one in charge. And while on the surface such orderly theology can seem comforting, everything in its place, everything happening according to the plan, as we dig deeper into it, it's disturbing and harmful. One of the classic explanations of what's happening on the cross is that Jesus is paying a debt for our sins. The idea is that humanity has been so sinful that someone needs to be punished to satisfy God's wrath and need for justice. But the only punishment costly enough to cover how awful we have been is for God's own Son to take the sentence for us. There are many things that are problematic with this teaching, but chief among them is the way that it flattens something so complex and mysterious into a simple economic transaction. We have been bad, and someone has to pay. It's tidy. And it turns God into a cosmic child abuser. It's horrific. It is an affront to our God whose name is love. To suggest that God would choose their own son's death to satisfy their own appetite for justice. It cannot be. I think there in the garden, Jesus points us to what is truly happening, to what has been happening all along, and to what is happening on the cross, and to what continues unfolding today. With each story he offers, with each meal he shares, with each moment of healing he enters into, and now with the suffering he endures, Jesus is choosing to hold on to us. He's experiencing in his own body what it is to be fully human. He is not taking any shortcuts or an easy way out. And through it all, because of it all, he is entering into deep relationship with us. By knowing our pain, he is with us. The saving grace of the cross is not the result of a transaction, a debt paid. The saving grace of the cross comes through his presence and his willingness to join humanity, even in death. Friends, our community has suffered a lot of loss this spring. Losing one beloved member after another in quick succession. In times like these, I think it matters even more that we remember this God who walked among us and who died. It was not sleight of hand. He was not playing possum. It wasn't a drawn-out magic trick. He, like those we love and see no longer, died. He breathed one last time and then he stopped. His friends carried his heavy body away and prepared him for burial. When I slow down to take in this truth in its fullness, it takes my breath away. Stops me in my tracks. And then, slowly, as my breath returns, it brings me back to the wisdom he offered us all along and offers us still. He did not lose a single one of us. And he will not lose us now, come what may. Meeting his presence in our suffering reminds me to return to his question then and try to live it out. Whom are you looking for? On beautiful days and terrifying days and tragic days and everything in between, whom are you looking for? It can be tempting to look for a scapegoat or a mighty hero or a magician, but these won't fix the pain of the world, not in any lasting way. Instead, I hope we can look for the one who breaks bread with us, who heals us, who walks with us through it all, especially on our most harrowing days. I hope we can look for the one who knows our suffering from the inside out. It is only with this most human God that we can walk through the whole of life and trust that somehow grace will pervade it all.